Mountain Gap Church welcomes you to join us as we share this kingdom message of hope.
The root was fear. If the fear is dealt with, there's no more dishonesty. And if there's no more dishonesty, there's no more collateral damage. You get it? We all have things inside. Fear, lust, greed, you know, covetousness. There's selfishness, you know, self-agendas, promoting ourselves. There's all these things that are just not like God. And He takes us over our lifetime, and He allows these life circumstances to happen. And in those circumstances, as we continue to ask Him what to do about these circumstances that we deal with, He begins to reveal the solution for the circumstance and the revelation of the root of the issue that has to be dealt with in here. Good to be here today. Really enjoyed our drive down today. It was a beautiful morning, and we saw all of it. Some of you got that. It's an interesting time of year, isn't it? It's one of my favorite times of year, and I hope all of you have had a good week, good Thanksgiving week. I hope you've had all the turkey that you want for the next 30 days, right? I don't know about you, but when I grew up, I dreaded Thanksgiving when I was little because my mama, she didn't throw away anything. And that turkey, I was convinced that if it stayed in the refrigerator overnight, it grew. Because 6 days later, there's only so many ways you can make a turkey sandwich. So we minimize our turkey intake usually and figure out other ways to have Thanksgiving. You know, the whole concept of Thanksgiving is pretty interesting. I don't know if you remember as a kid in elementary school learning and listening to the teacher talk about, you know, the Indians and pilgrims all got together and they shared a meal and were thankful for their time and together and for what God had done. And I thought, you know, that's an interesting thing. It even somewhat relates to the message today. How two groups of people who were somewhat adversaries just struggled with each other, put in a place where, you know, it just didn't feel right. And yet they came to this consensus that, you know, we all have things we can be thankful for. And maybe we should sit down and pause and try to understand each other and try to be a little more inclusive with relationships and not be so divided. And so I think that's a good thing for all of us to pause and reflect on. And it really kind of reflects today to the message, which very interesting message today. I've been working on this one for about a week, a little over a week. Actually was sitting in a deer stand when I started praying about, Lord, what do you want me to talk to the folks at Mountain Gap? Amen. I got amen on that one. So I didn't get to go this week because I was working on this message. But the Lord spoke real clear to me, and He said, talk to them about Abimelech. And I thought, Abimelech? Who is Abimelech? I mean, I knew the name, but, you know, if you had to just tell me who Abimelech was, there might be a few in here that could just rattle off his whole deal, but not many of us could just do that. You know, it's not like talking about David or Paul, you know. And so I had to go do a little research, but it was really interesting how this came about, because it's a fascinating story. You know, we always watch TV or go to movies and you see, well, there's a good guy and it's obvious who the good guy is because the good guy's doing the good things. And then there's a bad guy and he doesn't do anything good. Everything he does is bad. And so you have this real clear line of good guy, bad guy. And this story, the bad guy is the good guy and the good guy is the bad guy. And you look at it all and go, what? And the fascinating part of it is it draws us to some conclusions about our own lives, I think, that become useful. And so what I'm going to try to do is read you this passage. It's 18. This is in Genesis 20. I'm reading out of the NIV. But it's a very short chapter. It's only 18 verses. And in the history of Abraham's life, it is like a blip in the radar. I mean, you don't hear about it. There's nothing leading up to it. There's nothing after it's over. It's just life, blip, radar, life, and that's it. But it's one story. It's contained in 18 verses. And it really, there's so many moving parts in it that we really won't get them all. But we're going to hit some highlights. And what I want to do is I'm going to read it to you first. And then I'm going to define the two characters. One is Abimelech. One is Abraham. Sarah's kind of in the middle of this thing. But it's the two characters. I'm going to identify them and their personalities. I think that we can draw conclusions from this chapter. And then I want to talk to you about two things. One is, what does this teach us about God? Because he's always introducing himself to us. He's always saying, you didn't know this about me, but. And then I'm going to talk to you about what this means in our lives and how that works. Okay? So that's where I'm going. All right. So if you want to read along, you can. It'll be up on the screen. I'm going to read. This is Genesis chapter 20, and it's the whole 18 verses. It says, now Abraham moved on from there into the region of the Negev. For a while he stayed in Gerar. And there Abraham said of his wife Sarah, she is my sister. All right, just pause for a minute. This is culturally crazy, okay? All right, I'm going to come back to it, but this is insanity in this culture. Okay, then Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent for Sarah and took her. Okay, now when it says took her, it means that he included her in his harem because he had multiple wives. Okay, strange culture, very different from ours, but this is what's going on. Okay, so we hadn't got in this thing, but two verses, it's already gotten crazy, right? But God came to Abimelech in a dream one night. Now, and everything for the next few verses is the dream that Abimelech had. Now, if you know anything about a dream, you know that you actually can play both sides of the dream. In the dream, you can play both sides of whatever it is you're dreaming about, and you don't know what the other side is going to do. Do you know that? When you have a dream and you're imagining something, you can actually not know what the other person's going to do on the other side, and yet when it all unfolds, you understand the conclusion. Does that make sense? So Abimelech is a pagan man. He does not have any knowledge of God at all. And so he has this dream. All right. But God came to Abimelech in a dream one night and said to him, you are as good as dead, because the woman you have taken, she is a married woman. Now Abimelech, and here he is in his dream, still dreaming, had not gone near her. So he said, Lord. Now why did he call him Lord? He didn't know the Lord. Obviously in the dream, it was divine, right? God was speaking to a pagan man, which he can do. And this pagan man recognized, that's the Lord. It's something how in our deep spirit, we just know it, don't we? When he starts moving in our lives, we know that's God. That's God moving right there, because nothing else would have ever worked to make that happen. That's God. It's going on in the subconscious of this pagan king. And he's still in his bed asleep. And this is what he says to him. He says, you are, I'm sorry, let me get back to where I was. He said, all right, this is verse 4. He says, Lord, will you destroy an innocent nation? Did he not say to me, she's my sister? And did she not also say he's my brother? I have done this with a clear conscience and with clean hands. Interesting perspective from what we'd call a bad guy. Then God says to him in the dream, God's speaking now in the dream, yes, I know you did this with a clean conscience. And so I have kept you from sinning against me. And that is why I did not let you touch her. So she's in his harem. She's been in the harem for a while, as we're fixing to find out, but he has not been intimate with her. Okay, this is just, he's just included her in his group of wives. Strange culture. Now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you and you will live. And if you do not return her, you may be sure that you and all who belong to you will die. Early the next morning, can you say early the next morning? Can, if you had a dream like that, would there not be an early the next morning? This guy's rattled. Early the next morning, Abimelech summons all his officials. And when he looked, when he told them what had happened, they were very much afraid. And then Abimelech called Abraham in and said, "What have you done to us? And how have I wronged you that you have brought such a great guilt upon me and my kingdom? You have done things to me that should never be done." Now this is the bad guy talking. And Abimelech asked Abraham, "What was your reason for doing this?" Now, we'll come back to this in just a minute. But he's putting Abraham on the spot. Abraham has a lot of possibilities of what he could say right here. What he doesn't do is he doesn't apologize. Odd, don't you think, for a good guy? Abraham replied, "I said to myself, there is surely no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she really is my sister." In other words, I didn't really tell you a real lie, just a misled truth. "She's the daughter of my father, but not of my mother, and she came to be my wife. She became my wife. And when God had me wander from my father's house, I said to her, 'This is how you can show your love to me. Everywhere we go, you say of me, he is my brother.'" Weird. Just weird. Okay, we'll come back to this in a second. "Then Abimelech brought sheep and cattle and male and female slaves and gave them to Abraham, and he returned Sarah his wife to him, and Abimelech said, 'My land is before you, live wherever you like.' And to Sarah he said, 'I am giving your brother 1,000 shekels of silver, this to cover the offense against you before all who are with you. You are completely vindicated.' And then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech, his wife, his female slaves, and they could have children again. For the Lord had kept all the women of Abimelech's household from conceiving because of Abraham's wife Sarah." Is that not a strange story? All right, so we have to understand a few things. One is, in this culture, women had to keep veils on their face if they were married. Okay, there was something about the culture. Men did not, if a woman was spoken for and she was married, then she had to cover herself. All right, so what happened here was when they said, "This is my brother and this is my sister," she was uncovered. Okay, her face was uncovered. So the king could see her face, which said to the king, "I'm interested," or "I'm not interested." Okay, but in his mind, he was gazing on her beauty. And so he was choosing that he liked her. He liked the way she looked. And so he called for her. He said, "Go." In other words, it's just weird. They were trading women like trading animals. You understand what I'm saying? It's a strange culture. It's sick. All right, but it's where this was. The story took place 4,000 years ago. Okay, that's a long time. And in the Bible timelines, you can find how this fits into the timelines and where it was. But the culture was very strange. And so the king had seen her face, and therefore he thought she was available. And so he sent for her to come be a part of his harem. And so she became into his house. And even though he had not been intimate with her, She was engaged in all of the household things that the king would have had in his own palace. And so she stayed there long enough for the king to notice that we have a problem, because now none of our wives and none of our slave women or any of the concubines, none of them are having children. And so it's been a period of time, and he's recognizing there's a problem, and God shows up in a dream. So he knows that the dream is real, and he knows that there's something significant. That's God doing something. The supernatural sovereign God of the universe is visiting me in my dream. Now let's pause right there just a second. That's the story. Let's pause right there and let's ask the question, well, who is Abimelech? Abimelech is a word that means father is king. And it's used sometimes in kingdoms of the Palestinians. So they're a pagan culture. They have belief systems that are foreign and pagan. They were enemies of what became the Hebrews. Okay, but they had this because they did not know God. They didn't understand Him. They didn't want to know who He was. They were very vile people. They were harsh people, hard and hardened. And you know, Goliath kind of came out of some of that track. So blasphemous people. So the culture of that kingdom there in Gerar would have been very, we would call secular, or there a lot of debauchery, a lot of immorality, a lot of things that would have gone on in that kingdom that would not have gone on and honored God. And so here this king Abimelech is, and he's there, and he's in charge of this kingdom in Gerar. And the word Gerar means lodging place. Now, how did Abraham get here? That's the next question. And so, there's actually a picture of the map. There it is. See where Gerar is? It's right there in the middle in the red. That it's actually south of Jerusalem and Jericho and Bethlehem. It's right there in the middle between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. It's in the southern part of Israel. Now, you have to remember back that Abraham had two promises from God. One is that if you'll leave your father's house and travel to where I'll take you, to a land you do not know. You remember this? He said, everywhere you put your foot, I'm going to give you that land. So the requirement was Abraham had to walk the land in order to get it. All right? And then the other thing was, he said, I'm going to make you a great nation. Your children will be like the sand of the sea. So, and by this time, he's at least a middle-aged man. All right. He's not real young here. All right. So there's two promises that Abraham has seen no fruition of at all. But he knows the Lord has asked him to do something, and he is attempting to do it. And so he's walking from the top part of Israel, which is the very beyond the northern border of Israel, is where he started. And he's walking down north to south through this country. And he is vulnerable, because he's in that day, clanning up was something that made things safe. So if you had a lot of children or a lot of grown sons, and you know, there were weaponry and there were clans that moved together, it was something like safety in numbers. All right, and so in this situation, Abraham was alone, with the exception of a few, you know, that he had with him. He had some wealth, but he was somewhat vulnerable, and so he's walking. And I'll get to his personality in just a minute, but basically he's walking into this kingdom of these people that are pagan, that have no fear of God whatsoever, and he has to engage them because he needs to settle in this area. And so it's about territory. It's about possessions. It's about who's in charge. It's about all of these things. And so he's walking into these strangers, and he recognizes there's no fear of God here. And so the only thing he knows to do with the internal fear he has is to lie. And so he lies about his wife, and then he puts her in a very awkward spot, wouldn't you say? I mean, what's the plan out of this? You know, let's do this for a few months, and then one night we'll sneak away and take off to somewhere else. I mean, what's the ending? I just let you know, she's really my sister. terrible character, wouldn't you say? I see, I'm getting ahead of myself. I just can't believe this guy would do this. I'm already jumping ahead of my notes, all right? Abimelech, we know from the text, we can gather this from the text if you go back and read it. One is he's the king, so he's wealthy. He has livestock. He has male and female slaves because it says he gave some away. He has large amounts of silver because he gave away 1,000 shekels. He is strong. He has a sizable kingdom because he's intimidating because it's a pretty good sized place. He's organized because the next day, the first thing he did was call his officials together and say, "Hey, I had a dream last night." He's hospitable because his first instinct with Abraham was not to see his vulnerability and kill him. His first instinct was to make peace with him. He didn't have to make peace with him. He was stronger than Abraham. But he chose to make peace, so in his heart there was hospitality, or he was hospitable. The next thing about him is he was conscientious. He was alarmed at the dream. There were many kings that you can read about in the Bible who were arrogant and full of pride and they were loose and reckless. And they would have responded to this dream in a different way. But Abimelech chose to see it as a consciousness that there's something significant happening here. He's forgiving this man that he could still kill. You know, I mean, Abraham's fate is still in his hands. He could still kill him. He chooses to forgive him. And he chooses to extend grace to him. And all of those things are God-like character. Pagan man, unforgiven, unrecognizing of his era, but God-like character. Got it? Let's look at the other side. By the way, there's 14 of those 18 verses that deal with Abimelech out of that one passage, out of that one chapter. This situation could have gone a lot different if it had been a different personality king. Abraham, on the other hand, let's look at him. He had some wealth, but he wasn't wealthy. He was a wanderer, so he was somewhat weak. He was depending on the Lord. He was following the Lord. He was doing what God had asked him to do. But in his mind, he was weak because he was choosing to lie and be deceptive, right? So he had to come to that conclusion that he would have to do that because he felt like he was weak. He was deceptive. He was fearful. Because he was engaging people that he thought were a lot stronger than he was. He was dishonest. Now this is the father of the faith I'm talking about. You getting all this? Okay. A wanderer, guarded. He was, you know, distrusting, deceptive, fearful, dishonest. Am I going somewhere? You starting to get a pattern here? He was not sorry. He didn't apologize. Which means his conscience was hardened. But he was anointed. Is someone else having a problem connecting these dots? There is an understanding that we have that if we're good, we can get anointing. And that if we're bad, there's no chance. Now, I'm not going to split any theological hairs here this morning, okay? But I just want to point out that God chooses who he wants to choose for assignments that he wants them to do. And they're not all good and right and clean and perfect and spotless when he starts the process. That's good news for me and you. So here you have the good guy being the bad guy, and the bad guy being the good guy. Strange. So you ask, why? What is God doing? What is it that he is, what is it about God we learn in a story like this? Well, there's always God traits that we learn about God in the Old Testament, especially. The entire Old Testament is God introducing himself to humanity. And he does that through history. And we have the privilege now, looking way back, to see all of these great stories that tell us things about God. The first thing that it tells us, this one chapter, is he's a protector. If he asks you to do something, he will protect you in the process to do it. You don't have to worry or have fear. If he has told you to do something, he will provide for you what you need to do it. Strength, emotionally, materialistically, physically. He will provide for you what he needs, and he will protect you in the process. God is a protector. You see that right here. Second thing you find out is that God is gracious. In the midst of our errors, and we all have them, in the midst of our errors, God is gracious to us. He does not give us what we deserve every time we're wrong. That's good news for me. He's a God of principle. If something is out of order, he expects it to get back in order. And so he provides, out of his grace, he provides instruction for us to be obedient to set it back in order. Does that make sense? So even when we're out of order, when he's calling us back into order, even when he's addressing something in our lives, he's doing that out of his grace to us. Because he could judge us and it just be over. But he chooses out of his heart. His heart is gracious to us. It's kind to us. It's like a loving father would be to a little kid, you know. Yeah, you had a bad day. Yeah, you shouldn't hit your sister. Yeah, I know. We got to deal with that, but I still love you. Father is that way. The fourth thing, is that he forgives us. He chooses to forgive us. Anytime that we are in a place where we're willing to ask for his forgiveness, he is always, always there to forgive us and set it back right. He would rather forgive us than judge us. He's not a harsh God. He's a protector. He's gracious. He's a God of principle and order. And he's a forgiver. He loves to forgive. And the last thing about God we learn in this one chapter is that he restores hope. He takes a bad situation and he creates an opportunity to restore hope. Now, it's important for us to recognize all of those things because that's the God that we sing to and sing about. It's the God we all come in here to talk about. Our God is gracious. That's what makes him great. Is he's not out to crush us. He's out to heal us. He's out to take those spots in our character that are not like him and work on those through the course of our lifetime. And what he's doing is he's taking us on as a fixer-upper. You know the TV show? The old 70s farm ranch houses that all get turned into whatever and everybody loves watching them. He can see that old house as what it can be when it's finished. And he is actively working in all of the details to get that thing to looking from what it used to look like to what it's going to look like. And he's doing all of that in every one of us at one time. There's some life lessons here that we can learn right here. One is that God uses, this is number one, God uses our life circumstances to develop our personal character. We would love a life where there was money left over and there were plenty of family and all of them got along great and all the cousins got along great and everybody came over and there was perfect meals and no flies and everything was great and we would love life to be perfect. We all strive to create a perfect life for ourselves and our family. But there's always something or someone that we wrestle, every one of us wrestles with some, whether they're at work, whether they're people at work, whether they're people, you know, in the family, whether they're people in the community. You know, it just seems like life's not perfect. God didn't tell us it'd be perfect. But what God's doing is he's taking those imperfect situations and he's using that to make us get a little uncomfortable. It's not that he doesn't want us to be comfortable. It's that he needs to clean out that spot. And sometimes you need a pressure washer, not just a cloth. So God uses our life circumstances to develop our character. Second thing is, God reveals our, let me say it this way, God reveals our lack of character in our mistakes. That just doesn't feel good, does it? If Abraham had not had fear in his heart and distrust that God would provide, because he did not understand that God was his protector. He did not understand that. Because of that, there was fear. And in that fear, it made him do dishonest things that had consequences not just for himself, but for others, his wife, and for an entire kingdom. So the root was fear. If the fear is dealt with, there's no more dishonesty. And if there's no more dishonesty, there's no more collateral damage. You get it? We all have things inside. Fear, lust, greed, you know, covetousness. There's selfishness, you know, self-agendas, promoting ourselves. There's all these things that are just not like God. And he takes us over our lifetime and he allows these life circumstances to happen. And in those circumstances, as we continue to ask him what to do about these circumstances that we deal with, he begins to reveal the solution for the circumstance and the revelation of the root of the issue that has to be dealt with in here. And he was doing that for Abraham. And he was also introducing himself to a pagan king. He can do more in a day than we can do in a lifetime. Here's one that's a little true. This is number three. I'm uncomfortable with this one. Okay? Just being honest. He extends grace. God extends grace to both sides of the problem. I don't like that, do you? If I'm asking the Lord to help me, be my defender, be my shield, he extends grace to me, but he's extending grace to the same other side that's creating all my problems. I don't like that. And truth is, none of us do. Because we're right, because we're doing godly things, and they're wrong, because they're doing ungodly things, and they're the problem, and we're the solution, and if they just listened to us, it'd be okay. And God's saying, okay, maybe you're right, but my grace is bigger than your solution. My grace is bigger than your judgment of the circumstance. Ah, man, I don't like that. But that's what's good about him. Because sometimes I'm the problem. Now let me just back that up with Scripture, since that's a little touchy. Psalms 24:1. As a scripture, it says, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, and the world and all who live in it. Now, wrap your brain around that for a minute. There are politicians that I just, I get on Facebook and I see stuff and I have the ability to remain quiet. I have the right to remain quiet and not the ability. Politicians, corrupt people, people that don't exhibit God-like character, it's not easy for me to see that God would establish and give them grace. That's bigger than my finite mind can handle. But His infinite mind and His grace is bigger than my finite mind. So I can't judge those who are even wronging me. Oh, man, I know. Look at Joshua 5. This is an interesting passage to me in the Old Testament. Joshua has just come across the Jordan River that has just split down the middle and dried up in the riverbed. And he has marched 2,000 people across it. And he has landed in the new promised land that has been promised them to have. He has sized up that city called Jericho. He says, God's going to give it to us. It's a pagan group of people. And God's fixing to level it and give us that place. He's kind of feeling like, I'm following the Lord. Look what he's doing for me. This is good. He's about to take over. He's establishing his new territory. Joshua's kind of feeling his oats. But he's looking at this city and he's also thinking, this is a big deal. I don't know how I'm going to do this except that the Lord's given me some unusual instructions that I will follow. And it says, now when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword. Interesting pose, don't you think? It's a military man. And it says, Joshua went up to him and asked him, are you for us or are you for our enemies? Notice the answer. Neither. I'm not for either one of you. But as the commander of the Lord's army, I have now come. He's not for either one of them. The commander of the Lord's army is about doing what the Lord asked him to do. He's not picking sides. He's not playing favorites. He's not manipulating the situation of, come on guys, can't y'all just all get along? The commander of the Lord's army is on assignment from the king. And he says, I am now come. I'm not for either one of you. I'm here to carry out what the Father just said. God's establishing grace on both sides of the equation because God's intention is that none should perish. We live in this period of time, in this period of history between the cross and the second coming. And in this period of time is grace. God's unbelievable grace. And He's saying, you still have opportunity to follow me. You still have opportunity to turn from your wicked ways and come to me. You still have time because I'm giving you this season of grace. And the fourth thing that we learn is that He's asking us to forgive and let it go. Man, that's a hard one right there. Because Brian, you don't know what they did to me. It cost me something. It's not just okay. It cost me money. It cost me a relationship. It cost me a job. It cost me something, Brian. You don't know what it cost me. It cost Abimelech infertility for months and months and months. For the entire kingdom. Abraham, you've offended me and you've lied to me and now you've cost me something. But what I'm going to tell you is, here's some money, here's some gifts. Live anywhere you want in my kingdom. I release you. I forgive you. I let it go. That's a pagan. God has to work on us to forgive offenses. And it takes time. You can't just say, okay, cool, let it go. To get in here
to get in here where you can really let it go, it takes time. But God is committed to the process of time if we will commit to the process of trying. And He will do for us what we cannot do. Matthew 5 says it this way. You have heard that it said that love your neighbor and hate your enemies, but I tell you to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. There's a difference in letting it go and being able to pray blessing. But praying blessing on someone who's offended you is a hard, hard, hard thing to do. And Jesus is saying, there's been a bar set, but I'm about to set a new one. This is the one I'm setting. Jesus is talking. He's saying, this is the bar I'm setting. Don't just love your friends. Love your enemies. And on top of loving them, pray for them. That you may be, and this is why, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. In other words, I want you to look like me. For you to look like me, you got to act like me. And if you're going to act like me, you've got to be willing to carry what I'm carrying. And you've got to be able to size up situations like I do. If you're going to be like me and I'm the teacher and you're the student, then you've got to come along where I'm going. And what I'm saying is we got to set a new bar. Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Told you this was a weird message. God is taking us on a journey. If we're vertical, if we wake up this morning, we're vertical. We're a part of the journey. We're in the journey. He hasn't finished. We're in the process. And He's teaching us in this process to be like Him. And as long as we're committed to trying and be obedient and receive His grace and His protection, and understand that He has a sense of order that we have to try to maintain. As long as we're doing the things that we can do, He will do the things that we can't do. Now I know there are people, and I've had it too, where you invest your time in someone. You invest your time, and maybe you show some goodness. Maybe even some generosity. And somewhere along in those relationships, that love or goodness is not returned. And you feel like, you know what? I'm done with that person. Because I extended kindness. I extended goodness. I extended generosity. I extended help. I invested in that person. And they've stabbed me in the back. And I know that does not feel good. I deal with 18-year-olds every day. I can tell you, that does not feel good. But in that, that's kind of what we did to Jesus. He was good. He was gracious. He healed people. He was generous. He was loving. He did miracles. And they killed Him. And we would have been the same if we had lived then and been in that culture. Now, I'm so grateful that we don't live in that culture. I'm so grateful we live in this culture because we have the privilege of looking back and seeing it and analyzing it from a different perspective. And that's a benefit to us that they didn't have. But God is working, and what He's saying is, I know you've invested. But in that investment, see that as an investment in me. You didn't make that investment in that person. You made the investment because you loved me. And I'm keeping record of your deeds. So let me handle the distrust. Let me handle the disrespect. Let me handle the love that is only going one way or only went one way and didn't come back. Let me handle all that. You just be free. Be free. Be free. And let it go. We got a pay cut at Emmanuel a few years ago. It was kind of painful. Had some financial issues and working through it. And of course, a lot of people got shook. But there was, I ate lunch with a guy the other day, and he had just gotten there a year before it happened. And he said to me, he said, "Brian, I'm not angry about that." He said, I know these faculty members have been angry about that. I'm not angry about that. He said, "The Lord spoke to me and said, I know you've lost some money, but would you consider it a gift to me?" The Lord told him, "Would you consider what you've lost as a gift to me?" And he said, "You know what? Every month when my check comes in less than what it was, it's like, yeah, Lord, I'll give you that. I'm happy to give you that." Offenses are things that are really kind of sour. And they can get embittered and embedded in our hearts. And they can be like anchors or like weights on our shoulders. And we carry those things every day. And what the Lord says is, "I want you to trade your yoke of your weights for mine. And I'll give you mine because they're light. And you don't have to worry about that. And you can be free in your heart of those offenses. You can be free in your heart of where you've been mistreated and where you've been taken advantage of. You can be free and not have to carry that anymore. If you'll just take my yoke, I'll swap you. I'll carry that for you. I know what happened, and I can make a way to fix it." When I first came back to Emmanuel in 2009, they were in the middle of settling a contract. They were trying to hire a company to do some work, and I knew a couple of the people that were in submitting bids for that, and they settled on one, and we went with it. A few years later, one of my friends, who was one of the people that had submitted a contract, started really slandering me personally to people in the community. And I thought, "Well, what's that all about?" And then it got worse. And then I started hearing it from other states. So I knew it was getting out there. And it angered me. It made me mad. Because I thought, "I haven't done anything to this person. Why would they treat me this way? We were friends." And so first year or two, I just kind of got in my flesh and just went, "Okay, no time for that. Put up the wall. Put up the protection wall. Keep me from feeling anything. That person's not a friend anymore." We've been rocking along for several years like that. Now, I'm working through this stuff too. I'm not bringing this to you as if I got there. I'm wrestling with it too. And at homecoming this past year, there was a show that we were doing, and it was ticketed. And so people from the community were calling, you know, "How much does it cost to come?" It was $20 a person. Okay. And so I was in charge of that, and my administrative assistant came to me, because she was aware of the situation, and she said, "So-and-so called and wanted to know how much tickets were, and I told them $20 a piece." And she said, "I wonder what they're coming for." Just being real. And I said, "Okay." And I went on to my office. Over the afternoon, I got thinking about that and thought, "You know what? I'm not holding that anymore." So I went back to my assistant instead of calling the person directly, because if I'd have called the person directly, my assistant would have thought that I was cutting her knees out from under her for just implementing office policy. And so I went back to my assistant and I explained that. I said, "You call her back and tell her that we got 4 tickets waiting on her at the gate. It won't cost her anything, just a gift." And it was almost like in my heart, it was like, "I'm going to lay that offense down. I don't want to carry that thing anymore. I just don't want to carry it." It takes effort for me to carry an offense. Because sometimes it affects where I go, where I eat, what I do. I mean, think about it. If you're offended and you run into somebody that you've had offense with, "Oh, not eating there tonight. We're going to Burger King." You know, I mean, you do. You move around people that make you uncomfortable. I just said, you know what? I'm just tired of carrying that. Give her four tickets. Great. Tell her, come on. Love to have her. Well, my assistant called. About 2 weeks later, the president comes to my office. He says, hey, you will never believe who I saw at church. He was preaching at a church somewhere. You will never believe who I saw at church. Really? You'll never believe what they said to me. They're going to give us a gift. And it was paying for some things for the college for the next year. I said, how about that? He said, you call them. And set up a lunch, kind of figure out what it is that they want to do to help us and how we can be a part. And I called. And they said, you know what? I said, thank you for this. I don't know what to say. Thank you. It was very kind. Was not expecting that. You know what they said? They said, I've been embittered at you and the college for the last 2 or 3 years. My heart has not been right. And I just want to do what I can do to fix that. I had a choice. I could have charged $20 a ticket. I could have ignored the problem and worked around it. But that problem got resolved because God solved it. But he had to wait till I was willing to lay it down before he was willing to solve it. And I just believe in this time of Thanksgiving, when it's Indians and pilgrims sitting across this table from each other, major problems, major awkwardness, can't even speak the same language, and yet they're making a choice to be gracious and have peace and to forgive. I believe we're in a season of time where God is doing that in our midst, if we'll let Him. Sometimes we have to be like this pagan king, and we have to say, yeah, you offended me. And yeah, it cost me something. It wasn't just an offense. It cost me something. But I'm going to choose to lay that down, and I'm going to choose to bless you, and I'm going to choose to pray for you. And I'm going to let the Lord do whatever He decides to do from here, but I'm not carrying this one anymore. I'm done. We're the winners when we do that. We're the winners. They may get some forgiveness and be relieved, but we're the winners. And Jesus is saying in that process, now you're getting it. That's what I'm trying to get you to do. I'm willing to let you struggle to bring you to that conclusion. So we're going to stand, if you will, and I don't really know that I had a closing to this service, really. I just felt like that was for somebody here today. And if it wasn't, it was definitely for me. And the Lord is working in all of our lives. And He's wanting to remind us that He's still in charge. He's got this. He's protecting us. He's caring for us. He's providing our needs. But He is asking us one thing, and that is to learn to be like Him and respond as He does.
Thank you for joining us today. Mountain Gap Church offers our community Sunday worship and Wednesday night teaching and discipleship classes. If you would like further information on times and location, you may find us online at mountaingap.org.